Meeting will call to, will come to order. Does somebody want to move Representative Atkins Bill 2811?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Representative Atkins Bill 2811 for him.
Moved Representative Atkins, I think you said a minute and a half.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll move rapidly. I've got three authorized amendments. I would ask that the 1333 and then the 1334 and the 1335 amendments be offered.
Representative Bigham, I assume you move them.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move those three amendments.
Oh, that's right. Okay, we'll do the 33 first. All in favor of the 1333 to put it in the order the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Yep.
Next, the 1334. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Next, 1335. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Atkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this is essentially a technical cleanup sort of bill. I'm more here to answer questions than anything else. And I do have a gentleman from the accounting group here with me as well. It passed the previous committee unanimously on a voice vote. I believe that we are here, Mr. Chairman, because there was a violation provision or discipline provision. We have not received any arguments against that at all, and I'm not aware of anybody that's here to testify against that. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy either to address them myself or to have my witness here.
Is there anybody that wants to testify on this bill? Okay. Are there any questions from members? Representative Willing.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for you, sir. I was wondering why we need to hear this in our committee.
Representative Lilly, I have no idea why I was here.
We're happy to be here, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lilly, and I am told, by the way, it passed the Senate 60-0 yesterday.
Actually, Representative Lilly, it's my understanding, as Representative Atkins said, that there were some discipline changes, which means that it did have to come here.
And Mr. Chair, we had some minor amendments that we had to make to address the bill up.
But you wanted to get us all.
It worked out
for the floor. Oh, and Representative Atkins had also had a data practices element.
Indeed.
So it had to come here for two reasons, Representative Lilly. All in favor of the motion by Representative Bigham to and refer to pass and refer to general orders, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry.
Mr. Chair, I'm told that
no.
It needs to go to GovOp.
Oh. Representative Bigham, reconsider.
Mr. Chair. And I'll move that 2811. Go to government op.
You can't until after.
Oh, all right.
So the motion for reconsideration is open for debate. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Representative Bigham now moves that 2811 be passed and re-referred to government operations. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Sherry. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've got a couple left, both of which are quick as well. Which one do you want to do?
Representative Atkins, we'll do number 2911 if somebody will move that. Not doing well, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, I'll move it.
Representative Holberg moves 2911. I see an amendment. Is that author's amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I move that as well.
Thank you. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Atkins, are we just straightening out your bills before they're ready for the floor?
I appreciate your help, Mr. Chair. This is it's actually a very simple bill. It was, and it does not, I'll start by saying it does not undo the ability to resell tickets that passed last year. That concern was raised with the original version of the bill. As amended, you can still resell tickets. You can still resell tickets for a little bit more money. All this gets at is what took place, frankly, with the Miley Cyrus concert. And that was that there is the ability to use computer software to cut in line ahead of everybody else that's electronically online waiting to buy tickets. You can use computer software to cut ahead of everybody else and buy up. And that's what happened. They cut in line, they bought all the tickets, and then they got online and resold them all at 10 or 20 or 30 times the face value. There's a lawsuit going on to try to prevent this, I believe out in California. This just simply says that you can't do that. It's no different than if you had people camping out waiting for tickets and some big bully came walking by and elbowed everybody out of the way and went to the front of the line and bought up all the tickets. As far as I understand with the amendment, I'm not aware of any opposition. There's still some concerns out there from the Wolves and the Twins and the Vikings. They want to make sure they understand how it operates, but they actually were helpful with the amendment, and I've run it by everybody that was willing to listen, that the amendment just goes after that software and prevents the folks from being able to use that software to cut in line and buy up all the tickets. And with that, I appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone that wants to testify on this bill? Representative Atkins, have you cleared this with Representative Kahn and De La Forest?
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest tracked me down when he first saw the bill being, and so did Representative Kahn. I assured him I was not looking to undo their work from last year. But I think Representative LaForest can speak for himself.
Representative LaForest.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I just did have a question. I understand the thrust of the bill, and I'm sympathetic to it. You know, I don't think using software to defeat the line is a good thing. But the question I did have, Representative Atkins, is why using the criminal code so is the best way to go about this. I mean, there's obviously ways that can be used and means that can be used. I know that the teams themselves, for example, it's a measure, countermeasure kind of thing. We could also pursue legislation that would give them enhanced civil authority to initiate a case, for example. So why criminalize it? Why law enforcement is the best means to defeat what we agree is a problem?
Representative De La Forest, I wouldn't be averse necessarily to a civil penalty as well, but this is the equivalent of if somebody did this at the line, the physical line, as people were waiting to buy tickets, literally elbowing their way past to the front of the line, that's currently a crime right now. This just puts this in the same category as that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, the only concern I have going this route is that law enforcement has a full plate with cyber crimes, for example, already, and some of these cyber crimes are rather significant with respect to identity theft or even child pornography and the like, and so I'd prefer, you know, have some comfort. I don't know if law enforcement has signed off on this or not. I'm just worried that it diverts scarce law enforcement resources away from some of those issues to tracking down what, again, I agree is an issue, but doesn't rise to the level of some of the other issues that I referenced.
And Mr. Chair, very briefly, I believe that is a worthy concern. However, it's such a rare occurrence. I mean, as far as we understand, it's happened one time in Minnesota, but the prediction is that it may happen on an intermittent basis occasionally. So I don't think it's going to be an overwhelming task for law enforcement. If it happens often, I'll probably be back with some other approach.
Any other discussion? Okay, all in favor of the Holbert motion to pass as amended and refer to the general register, say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carry.
You want to do my last one?
Atkins, since you said you could do the total of four bills in 3 minutes at one time, and you've taken 12 minutes. Representative Atkins, somebody move 3397? Representative Lesh moves 3397, and are there any author's amendments to this?
Mr. Chair, I am not aware of any amendments with respect to this bill.
Representative Atkins, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I want to make sure, I think the engrossed version may be working its way around the table. I don't believe that will impact this committee in terms of whether you're looking at the original or the engrossed, because the purpose of having it before this committee, I believe, is with regard to the penalty portion, which allows for some civil penalties greater than $500, and specifies matters that the board must consider in levying those penalties. Most importantly, there is peace in the valley. This bill is now actually supported by both the board and the industry. Normally, as you know, the industry will have their bill moving separately, the board will have its bill moving separately, and they're both usually good bills. In this instance, the two of them got together and are supporting the same bill. And we're certainly welcome to call up members of the industry, Mr. Wilson, Mr. Bone, or Mr. Barrett from the Gambling Control Board. But I think they would just nod if they want to see that in fact there is agreement on the portion of the, there's agreement on the entire bill, and specifically with respect to the part that's before this committee, that they agree on that as well.
Is there any testimony on this bill? Anyone want to testify? Okay. Was there any members that want to discuss it? Okay. Representative Lesh renews his motion to pass and refer to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. That one you did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I think I made up time on that third bill, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
I thought you wanted to. Yeah. Representative Filtering?
That was really good.
Would somebody move the 3378 bill? Representative Kranz moved the 3378 bill. Representative Tilbury, I don't see any amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, Representative Tilbury, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This particular bill, I think, is simple. But I'd like to, we went through comments committee without having any difficulty with it. I think there was a couple questions that were asked, and they were taken care of right away. And the thing that I would like to say is that this just keeps the alcohol and gambling enforcement to enforce this particular law regarding the gambling device to make sure that it remains the same as what it was back in 63. Then they updated it in 89, and now they're asking for another clarification to make sure that the intent is the same as what it was. And I do have a test fire for any questions, if there are any.
Oh, he just made more. Are there any questions on the committee, Representative LaForce?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A question for Representative Tilbury. We have a repealer on line 15. Can you share with us what the repealer is?
Representative Tilbury.
Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Force, members of the committee, the repealer was that when Video Games of Chance was done away with back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of things that were repealed in moving the laws from the 349 statute to the criminal code, or just simply getting rid of them. This section remained for what I can only imagine is an oversight, and essentially created a circumstance where a manufacturer of a device for use outside of Minnesota was, the other sections of law did not apply. However, that created a tension with a later law, which required a license for manufacturers and distributors of gambling devices for sale or use in Minnesota. Since we believe the later law applied, but there is this tension between the two statutes, we simply thought the simplest thing was to ask the legislature to repeal the one section that created the tension, the older section of the law.
Any other discussion? Okay, Representative Kranz renews his motion to pass and refer to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish moves the minutes of March 6th and March 7th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry.
Thank you.
that.
Representative Marley, you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
3597.
Would move 3597, and I would ask that this bill go to the consent calendar.
Okay. I'll bet you would. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Marley, proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a clarification of what I think most people believe the law was, but the court said there was an ambiguity in the language of the statute. And the intent, I believe, all along was that the complaint would be, or the indictment or complaint for violation could be filed within either the later of 9 years after the commission of the offense, or 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. And that was, I believe, the intent of the original bill, but because of the ambiguities, the court held to the contrary. And we have a county attorney here to explain why this is needed in view of the court case. I believe it was Stacey Krikorian.
Thank you. I would testify or identify himself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Charles Glassroot. I'm the Stevens County attorney here from Morris, Minnesota.
Mr. Glassroot, go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did happen to have that case, and what it highlights is that you've got a 9-year period of time within which a child victim, when we're talking about under 18 victims of criminal sexual conduct, within which that person can report. But if they don't report within the 9 years, then the statute gives them 3 more years. What I ran into is a situation where they did report close to the end of the 9 years, then I didn't get the extra 3 years. And it appears that that's anomalous. So if you had a victim reporting 9 years and 1 day after it happened, you'd get 3 more years. If you got a victim reporting 9 years minus 1 day, you'd be done. You'd have a day to bring the charges if you could move that quickly. So the prosecutor, where the victim waits 2 days, has 3 more years to go. Another situation which happened to me was you get a brother and a sister, and the brother reports what happened to the two of them almost 9 years ago. So the sister never reports. If you bring your charges after the 9-year period, you can't go as to the brother, but you can as to the sister because the victim didn't report. Would that have been the legislature's intent? I think clearly it would not have been the legislature's intent, and it would be an absurd result. That was argued to the Court of Appeals. This is an absurd result, and they said, actually, it kind of reads plain on its face, so they pretty much invited the legislature to make a change. They said if there's to be change in the statute, it must come from the legislature.
Okay.
So here we are.
Thank you, Mr. Glassroot. And I would, Representative Mulready, we do have an A1 amendment to your bill on this, which appears to be necessary that it has an effective date. Was it your intent that we put this on to get the bill in shape that you so desire, the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then Representative Mulready moves the A1 amendment in order to get it in shape for final passage. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion passes. The A1 amendment is on. Could you, Representative Mulready or Mr. Glassroot, explain or clarify that for the purposes of the A1 amendment?
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the effective date, if you don't specify, as I understand it, then it's only going to apply prospectively to crimes committed now or after this date. But we're talking about things that could be almost 9 years ago that we want to save. So if you specify, as this has been written here, you're going to be able to relate back for any crimes as to which the statute has not already expired. And that would appear to be in line with following up on what was clearly the legislature's intent.
Are there any questions for Representative Mulready or Mr. Glassroot? Are there any other testifiers in the audience in support of House File 3597 as amended? any testimony in opposition? Seeing none, then, Mr. Moody renews his motion for passage of House File 3597 as amended to the consent calendar. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boland moves his bill 3775.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead and present your bill.
Before presenting my bill, I would
I believe there's an A1 amendment. Representative Olin, I believe you want to move your A1 amendment. Is that yours?
No, we don't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Olin, you don't need the A1 amendment. Okay.
I don't need the A1 amendment, but what I'd like to do is I believe move to delete Section 4 of the provisions, because Section 4 is the Mulberry bill, which has already been taken care of, so there's no need to have that in this bill also.
So Representative Olin moves the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Olin, go ahead.
Okay, what this bill does is clarifies a couple situations that have arose under the sexual contact provisions of the law. Specifically, criminal sexual contact, the second and fourth degree. And with me today to explain in more detail is Chris Carpen from the Dakota County Attorney's Office and Aaron Kuster from the Goodhue County Attorney's Office on Section 1 of the bill, and then I'll have a different witness on Section 2 and 3. So maybe Mr. Carpen can proceed.
Mr. Carpen?
Thank you. Mike, first of all, amend my county of residence to Douglas County, not Dakota. I'm the Douglas County attorney. Part and parcel of Mr. Weston, the jurisdiction over there. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill makes the presence of the intentional deposit of semen on a criminal sexual conduct victim a crime, a specific crime. And it is not right now, it is not codified in the criminal sexual conduct statute. Aaron Schuster next to me emailed me the proposed language of this bill last week, and I told her, by God, I could have used this bill last year. And as a result, they asked me to come testify and tell you about the real life situation I had where I could have used this language to hold someone responsible. Usually, ejaculation in criminal sexual conduct cases comes along with touch or penetration. It's not usually by itself. Not all the time. Let me tell you about a gentleman, and I use that term loosely, named Jeffrey Dacre in my county. Dacre was 38 years old and befriended two 14-year-old females who were employed as babysitters for him. Over a period of time, he did what offenders do. He groomed them with tobacco, alcohol, and eventually marijuana, and also introduced them to pornography to desensitize them. And then on one occasion, while watching pornography, he convinced one of the 14-year-olds to open his shirt, and one of his habits would be to masturbate while they're watching this pornography. And he did that act, but this time he got up and ejaculated on her chest. At that point, obviously he was planning further actions in the future. This was part of his progression of criminal sexual conduct. But one of the girls told the therapist before that happened. The report came to me, and the only thing I could charge him with was indecent exposure for doing that sexual act in front of the girls. This act of ejaculation on her is not codified as contact because his body never touched her body. I charged him with indecent exposure, and he pled guilty to that. Now, that's a gross misdemeanor offense, and it's non-registrationable. It's not a registration offense. It's punishable by a maximum of 1 year in jail and 2 years of probation. So I hit this guy with 4 months jail up front, which means that in actual time to serve, he has 4 months left maximum to serve. The point of this is we put him in sex offender treatment, and believe me, this guy needs it. He had a prior offense in 1999 in Freeborn County of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, which could not be prosecuted because the victim left the state. This guy has got some serious sexual dysfunction. If he flunks out of treatment, we ordered him to go to treatment on probation. If he flunks out of treatment, he's got 4 months of jail hanging over his head. He could do that standing on his head. That's what's going to happen here. He's going to flunk out of treatment. He's going to do his 4 months. He's going to be back on the street. And I'm going to get him again. I'll get him again, but it will be with a new victim. Had this statute been in place and this been considered contact, I would have been able to charge him with that. Aaron Keister from the Goodhue County Attorney's Office is here with me to talk about why this should be contact, why this is a bad thing. But just let me tell you, from experience, I can tell you that if this guy would have touched her breast over her shirt while watching pornography, that would have been a felony level criminal sexual conduct offense. Touching the private parts over the clothes or under the clothes is currently contact. What he did is much worse for her and much more personal and sexual than just touching her, and yet it's not codified as contact. Now, I'm not asking you to pass a bill based on one horror story from Douglas County, but I got 33,000 people. If I couldn't use this law, I can almost promise you it could have been used 100 times across the state probably in the last few years. I think it's going to be an increasing problem given the prevalence of pornography and the acts that go on in pornography. We're going to start seeing this more and more, I think. And that's all I got.
Representative Olin, do you have other witnesses?
Erin Houston's here to testify in that, too. She's from Goodhue County. I should make a note before I go on, just for a record for a change. Greater Minnesota is all my witnesses on this case, and here I tried to give this one to Backstrom County, and it wasn't even his.
Ms. Keister.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And the only reason why Mr. Carpin was able to prosecute this man with anything is because the victim was awake. And if you think about the fact that had this young woman been asleep, there would have been no crime that was committed that either he or I could have prosecuted the man for. There are similar acts of legislation that make it a felony level assault if someone is to throw urine or feces or blood or semen at correctional officers or police officers, but there's no equivalent under the sexual conduct law. And actually, I think it just makes common sense. It's a practical understanding of what is offensive and what's contact under the law. If you look at the act of masturbation, there really isn't any other reason for it other than sexual or aggressive intent. And that act could be very solitary in nature. But when you actually go the next step, where you masturbate to the point of ejaculation on someone's body or on their clothing, by that very nature, you are activating all of their senses. Their sight, their smell, their hearing, sound, their touch, and unfortunately, wherever the ejaculation may end up, it could be the case. Could there not be anything more offensive on a child's body or on a mentally or physically disabled individual or someone who is there unwillingly against by force or violence or by the use of weapons? We're simply putting in a different type of context an existing definition. We're not making it a crime by itself. And right now, provided that the individual who has the ejaculate on their body or on their clothing, if they were able, the child was able to be awake and experience it, the equivalent that he was able to get this person for, it doesn't do them justice. In fact, we're just trying to do what five other states have already done. Did some research before I came to you this afternoon. Five separate states have already adopted this legislation and realized that it just makes common sense. Thank you so much for your time.
Representative Lesh and then Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And questions for the testifiers. The reason I want to ask you about this is first for the individual who just testified. You stated that if she was asleep, there was nothing that you could have charged him with, not even disorderly conduct.
Well,
yes,
it was. Oh, excuse me. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm in the courtroom, and I last year I used to kind of, you know, muscling around. So, excuse me, Mr. Chair. No, because in order, I mean, you would have evidence. Absolutely, you would have a semen on that child's body, but there would be no ability to explain how it got there. So, beyond a reasonable doubt, we would have to have some explanation of who gave that semen, provided that the child did not do a normal reaction of washing it off or picking the clothing off or have a very guttural instinctive reaction. Perhaps that evidence could be preserved. Perhaps we could get a search warrant for whom we believe deposited the semen, and then we could actually perhaps figure out that by DNA that that semen belonged to that individual. By circumstantial evidence, we would believe that that person put that semen on that child, and then we might have disorderly conduct. Sure.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, but what you're talking about is more of a proof issue than it is a need for an additional crime, because when someone's asleep, that's just an issue of who sees them and what kind of evidence you have. Is that right?
Well, if I could, we're not making it an additional crime. We're adding a definition to the already existing definition to incorporate what we believe is lacking in the current statute. Huh? This element, the ejaculation on the body or on the clothing, would have to be in addition to all of the other characteristics which make the victim vulnerable, whether it be age, weapons, force, violence, or vulnerability due to mental or physical disability. So it's not, the proposal right now is not, it's making it a separate crime. It's including it in the type of action that would be counted as sexual contact.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate you attempting to explain it that way, but usually that's not the way things work. Now, I mean, when you're adding a new element in something that wasn't necessarily criminal under that section before, and it is now criminal, then it makes it a new crime. It, just like the gentleman from Morrison County said he could have used it. Douglas County said he could have used it before if it was in fact in the section. So, Mr. Chair, if I may, my next question is for the gentleman from Douglas County. I prosecute these things in St. Paul, indecent conduct, indecent exposure, and there's, I think, a wide variety of opinion on what these criminal defendants need in terms of probation. Some people think they need an entire battery of tests for sexually dangerous persons. I see people all the time who are down by the river in the park, and they're in there doing public sex acts back in the woods that they come in claiming are private, and they're in an area that no one could see them. But as far as many other people in the courts are concerned, they might as well be sexually dangerous persons and sexual predators. And based on your testimony, I see my question for you is, do you think that anyone who is, for example, accused, rightfully so, when probable cause is found on something like indecent exposure, should have to submit to one of these felony-level assessments?
Mr. Hartman. I don't know if you're asking me if I think indecent exposure should be a felony right off the bat. I don't. I think my, for what it's worth, indecent exposure the second time you do it within a number of years becomes a felony. So if you're a repeat exposure, you will reach that level. But what I think about this bill is the addition of semen on the victim, to me, translates as Aaron said, from indecent exposure or disorderly conduct, which is a misdemeanor charge, by the way, to something more. It just cries out for it. If you can get a felony for touching someone over their clothing in a sexual manner, to me, the conduct of ejaculating on them on purpose, when they're on victim status, meaning age or using force or violence, that's equivalent to me of touching, if not worse. And in my case, I think that this gentleman was worthy of the felony level charge.
Just in terms of comment, I appreciate that. And I think this is something that maybe needs to be vetted more in the committee in the future, because depending on the case, I absolutely agree. And there's some cases where I'm not so sure, depending on what happened in terms of the conduct. So that may be something that may come up in future bills on this. But thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, can I just follow up on that part? And it is for all of you to think about. I tried to think of a situation that fits this bill, intentional deposited semen on someone with victim status, meaning they're using force or violence or they're underage. When you pass a criminal statute, you throw a net out and catch a bunch of people in it. And the danger is you get someone in your net you don't want in your net. It happens now and then. I can't figure out, if you violate this bill, who'd be stuck in the net that shouldn't be there. And Representative, as you said, maybe there's a situation you can talk about in another committee where you say, I don't want this guy in the net. I couldn't think of one. If you do this act, I think it's worthy of fourth or second degree, from what I've seen in my prosecution.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olin, can you please help me understand what we're doing with the statute of limitations here? Because that, I don't think we've talked about that provision yet, which is on page 5, lines 12 through 16. I have no problem with
Representative Cole.
Deleted by my amendment, because that's in Mr. Mulry's bill, Representative Mulry's bill.
I'll be quiet then.
I do need to have testimony on section 2 and 3, although, because there is an explanation needed on that.
Yes, Representative.
So I'll call on Nathan Rice from Rice County to testify on that. It's an accurate or accomplice wording, and there's a reason why I need testimony on it.
Mr. Rice?
Yes, thank you, Representative Olin. Mr. Chair, my name is Nathaniel Rice. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney in the criminal division there. The purpose of sections 2 and 3 is to correct what I think is probably an oversight. I doubt this will be too controversial, but essentially what the current legislation does, as it's currently worded, is it treats accomplices and main actors differently, which is contrary to normal law. But actually, it stands it on its head, because it treats the accomplices more severely than it treats the main actors. The way it works is what could classically be termed as rape, which would be sexual penetration by force or coercion, would be a third-degree criminal sexual conduct offense. But there are certain cases under which that would be aggravated to a first-degree criminal sexual conduct offense. For example, if there's personal injury or force or coercion or a weapon, if there's personal injury or a weapon involved or fear of imminent great bodily harm and so forth, then it would be a first-degree offense. Well, one of those examples is a gang rape situation where there'd be more than one actor involved and there's force or coercion involved. That's the way it looks like the statute reads, but that's not exactly how it reads. The way it reads is that an accomplice has to use force or coercion. So not the person who's actually on trial, but the accomplice has to use force or coercion. So say you've got an example where there's somebody who's not using force or coercion but is an accomplice to this gang rape situation. For example, he's the lookout, or he's holding the door so the roommate can't get in, or something along those lines. That person would be guilty of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, because an accomplice, in our hypothetical, is using force or coercion to accomplish the sexual penetration. But the actor who's actually using the force or coercion to accomplish the sexual penetration is only guilty of criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, because his accomplice is not using force or coercion to accomplish the sexual penetration. I assume this is simply an oversight on the part of the legislature, and the added language corrects that for first-degree criminal sexual conduct in Section 2, and then if there's no penetration but merely contact, then the same problem is present with respect to second-degree criminal sexual conduct, and that is corrected in Section 3.
If there is any question? Mr. Wright, you lost me on this. Accomplice, okay. The accomplice is not on trial, but what they do is the felony of the higher level.
The way it's worded is, for it to be in a gang rape situation, for it to be a first-degree criminal sexual conduct, the accomplice has to be using force or coercion. So in our hypothetical here, Mr. Chair, with the lookout who's not using force or coercion and the actual perpetrator who is using force or coercion on the victim to accomplish the sexual penetration, the lookout is guilty of first-degree criminal sexual conduct because an accomplice is using force or coercion. But the actual actor is not guilty of first-degree criminal sexual conduct because an accomplice is not using force or coercion. The lookout is not using force or coercion. So the person who, I think most people would agree, is more guilty of the offense, the main actor, is only guilty of third-degree criminal sexual conduct, whereas the lookout would be guilty of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, which I don't think is anything the legislature ever would have intended. It shouldn't be a defense to first-degree criminal sexual conduct to say, oh no, it wasn't my accomplice who used the force of coercion, it was I who used the force of coercion. That shouldn't be a defense. But the way the law is written right now, it is a defense. It shouldn't matter who uses the force of coercion. If there's a gang rape situation, if either the actor or an accomplice uses force of coercion, it could be a first-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and forgive my ignorance on this. I haven't had a chance to review the section prior to coming in on the CEDA, but is there any possibility of the actor believing there was a consensual sexual act in the wake of coercion being used by the lookout? Is there any possibility of that scenario happening under this change?
Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I understand the representative's question. If there is a consent situation, consent is going to be a defense to these cases where there's force or coercion used to accomplish the sexual penetration. The consent is only not a defense in criminal sexual conduct if, for example, there's a position of authority or an age case or something like that where... Which is not what we'd be talking about in this type of situation.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and perhaps I just need to review the statute again, too, but it would essentially consent in this situation that I would envision, and my question about is concerning if the actor number two who did the sex act with the victim, there was no consent, but he was unaware that there was no consent because she was browbeaten into it by actor number one who acts as a lookout after that. But perhaps if the question is confusing, I can review it afterwards and determine whether or not that's a scenario in that jury instruction.
Okay, so, Mr. Rice. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the situation then would be where the lookout would be using the force of coercion and the person actually conducting the sex act did not use force or coercion?
Correct.
Is that the situation? Then you'd really have the same problem. It would just be flipped. In that case, the person who would be guilty of first-degree criminal sexual conduct would be the person committing the sex act because an accomplice, in that case, used force or coercion. But the person who actually used the force or coercion, the person who did the browbeating and so forth, would only be guilty of third-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Okay.
And in every area of the law, Mr. Chair, the accomplices are treated, every area I can think of in my practice, accomplices are treated the same way as the main actors. If you aid and abet somebody, you're just as guilty of the crime as the main person who committed the crime.
That answers my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Chair Mulley. Kind of a different scenario from Representative Lesher's is, what if the actor was using, the perpetrator was using the force to the victim, but told the actor there was no force, the person looking out on the room. So, like, if somebody said to their friend, watch this room while I go in there, and that the lookout didn't know there was force being used.
That would go to Mr. Chairman. That would go to the accomplice liability statute, which is a different statute, 60905, and that's referenced in the statute as it exists already. It's saying if an accomplice, as defined in 60905. If they're aided by an accomplice, it's defined in that statute. So they still have to be an accomplice, which requires knowingly aiding and abetting, counseling, conspiring, procuring, that kind of thing. So there is intent there.
Are there any other questions? Does anybody want to testify on this bill? Okay, then Olin renews his motion to pass as amended. Oh, as amended, and goes to the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. What? Representative Olin, you just moved to reconsider your motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Representative Olin now, I believe, states his motion that it passed as amended and be referred to finance with a recommendation that go to public safety finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Representative Hansen, I think, are you? Representative Hansen, does somebody want to move the 3429 bill?
Mr. Chair, I can move House File 3429.
Representative Big moves 3429. Are there any amendments to this? Okay. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3429 is the Department of Natural Resources bill relating to administrative penalty orders. Administrative penalty orders have been used in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for a number of years. Last year there was some authority extended to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources brought this bill to me. I have Mr. Japs with me from the DNR to go through the bill.
Mr. Japs.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jim Japs, J-A-P-S, and I'm the Assistant Director of the DNR Division of Water. There's three sections of this bill. The first section provides the DNR the authority to issue the APO and limits it to a maximum of $10,000 per incident. These penalties would all be collected and deposited in the state general fund. Section 2 has 9 subdivisions. The first subdivision relates to describing the contents of the order. The second subdivision determines the amount of the penalty based on several factors, including the willfulness and degree of impact to the resources. The details on actually calculating this penalty will be in an implementation document the department's required to develop in Section 3 of the bill. Subdivision 3 relates to issuing and responding and determining compliance with the order. Subdivision 4 allows for the penalty to be forgiven if correction actions are taken. Subdivision 5 provides the opportunity for an expedited administrative hearing pursuant to Chapter 14. And two paragraphs to point out, there would be paragraph D, where if the DNR prevails, the ALJ determines the case was frivolous and the hearing's costs could be added to the penalty. And to balance that, paragraph E says that if DNR does not prevail, the ALJ can dismiss the APO and the recipient can recover hearing and attorney costs. Subdivision 6 provides for alternative dispute resolution if both parties agree. Subdivision 7 defines enforcement options for failure to comply with the APO, and Subdivision 8 allows permits to be revoked for non-compliance of the order if the permits are related to the incident. And then Subdivision 9 allows APOs to be used in addition to other remedies. Section 3 then requires the DNR to develop a plan for implementation by the end of this year, and this would be done in lieu of doing rules.
Any questions, Representative Coles and then Holbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Representative Hansen or for your witness, Section 3 of the bill, recovery of litigation costs and expenses, why is that needed? Prevailing party in litigation now has the ability to collect, to recover costs and expenses by a simple petition at the conclusion of litigation.
Mr. Jeff.
Mr. Chair, Representative. This bill was developed using language from the Non-Felony Enforcement Advisory Committee, so we took the language from them, and we're just trying to use that as the model.
Mr. Chair, that's not terribly compelling to me, Mr. Japs. There is a current process that exists, and I haven't done civil litigation for several years, but I don't think it's changed in the last several years, where the prevailing party in litigation right now petitions the court and gets their cost as a matter of course, almost. I mean, the party that loses can dispute some of the costs, but it's handled typically by a clerk, not even a judge. At least in Hennepin and Ramsey County, I believe they're simply awarded. So just to have consistency with some group that I'm not familiar with when we already have a process, I'm not sure that that's a very good reason.
Mr. Jeffs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, you're referring to Subdivision 5?
No, I'm referring to Section 3.
Section 3? Mr. Chair, Representative, Section 3 requires us just to prepare a plan on how we plan to implement this. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Section 4 is the plan. Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to compare this to the other section of law to determine if that was necessary. I'm not sure why the advisory group included this
to this point.
To this point.
To this point, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles, and to the witness, I'm guessing, I don't know if this could be the case, but I'm guessing here, since this isn't styled in Section 3 on line 5.10, it doesn't say cost. Representative Coles is right. I mean, it would be kind of double treatment here if we put something in at the cost. I'm guessing, I don't know, but tell me if this is true, that this is meant to capture what would be the public sector equivalent of attorney's fees, which is some sort of, that's my guess.
No,
that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. That's what it is. It's not cost. It's meant to capture some sort of, you know, kind of an hourly rate, kind of a rate at which they would be paid were they billing at a private law firm. That's my guess. Is that true?
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. You stated that there's a $10,000 maximum and a penalty. How does that relate to other agencies and their maximum?
Mr. Jeff.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's the same penalty that the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture and everybody has. Our goal is not to have a $10,000 penalty. Our goal is to have compliance. So we're hoping for as low a penalty as possible.
And if I might, can you tell me other areas in which on page 4, subdivision 9, this cumulative remedy where you can stack all kinds of good things so you can throw at people?
Mr. Jeffs.
Where else do we do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's fairly common where you may issue we have a restoration order we could issue. We could issue a cease and desist order, so it'd be on top of those sorts of actions. The other type of penalty could be, or alternative would be a criminal citation, but we're trying to avoid that with this administrative penalty order.
Representative Holbrook.
All right, and then I'm also curious, back to Section 3 on page 5, line 511, 512, where in determining the amount of the litigation expenses to be allowed, the court shall give consideration to the economic circumstances of the defendant. Where else do we do that?
Mr. Jeffs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure where that exists.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hansen or Mr. Jeffs, the question I have is why can't we just leave it the way it is right now? I mean, not only does it sound like you're not very clear as to why certain things have been put in the bill, but the system that we have in place right now seems to work just fine. Why do we need to create another long arm of government to start issuing citations?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer. this actually helps reduce the citation. So we're not going into criminal court. We're providing an administrative way of trying to correct the action. And in the environmental arena, the ultimate goal here is to try to bring the folks into compliance. And this tool has been available through the Pollution Control Agency for a number of years. For example, if a wetland violation had occurred, this may provide a tool for getting that correction fixed and not having the criminal citation done, that the goal would be the remedy to fix that environmental problem. And so it should help provide a way of doing things to get on the ground the goal that we're seeking without going through the litigation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thanks. Representative Hansen, while I appreciate that, that's just wrong. You're not eliminating the criminal penalties at all, so those are still in place and those will still be enforced. And frankly, I've seen these water police, as we call them out where I am. They tend to run onto people's property when they shouldn't be there, and they look for things that they shouldn't be looking for. And I am very concerned that by giving this type of authority to these folks, not only are you going to unnecessarily and unreasonably increase not only the use of our criminal courts, but our civil courts now, you're creating, I think, what one representative talked about, the potential for a money grab and other issues. We don't need this at all, and I'm going to be interested to hear how much, if there are other questions, how much we actually know about the details that are in the bill.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, given the concerns of apparent one-sided nature of Section 3 and what may or may not be a backdoor attempt to sort of write attorney's fees into a statute but not be clear about it, I think that section absolutely needs more work, Mr. Chair, and I'm concerned about not really understanding why it's there. So, Mr. Chair, I would move to amend and to move to delete Section 3 of the bill.
Okay, Representative Coles moves to delete Section 3 of the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, Representative Hansen, if there's a good reason for this to be here, let's come back and, but I don't feel comfortable moving it out of the Public Safety and Civil Justice Policy Committee when we don't even understand why it's being asked for.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles of the amendment, I look at the key piece of this APO as the subdivision 3, the corrective order, and using that procedure. So Section 3, not Subdivision 3, I would be okay with the amendment.
Okay.
Chair, I'd move that amendment.
Want to speak to that?
I was going to speak against the amendment, but I've been accepted by the author. I guess I'll withdraw the comment. Thanks.
Okay. All in favor of the motion to delete Section 3, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Oops. It fails.
Division.
Division is called for. All in favor, raise your hand. Yeah. It carries. The amendment passes. Representative DeLaForest.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question for Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen or Mr. Japs, regarding subsection E, that's on page 3, beginning on line 32. It is possible for someone who's aggrieved to recoup some of their costs if the report recommends a dismissal of the order. But as I move up to line 24, it says the administrative law judge can certainly make changes. So my question is, what if I'm a citizen, I go to a hearing, let's say there are 10 changes I was supposed to make, and I'm successful in getting 9 of them deemed unreasonable, but one remains. Am I still ineligible to recover any costs based on the language beginning on line 32?
Mr. Jeff.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that would go to the
ALJ again for consideration.
I hope you're not asking me.
You're looking at me with a question. Well,
Mr. Chair, we do have authority to issue the order, so we could reconsider that as a package, and whether it essentially takes care of the restoration at hand. So I would say it would be a case-by-case basis.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should ask my question again. Mr. Japs, again on line 32, it says that if a citizen appeals the corrective order and has a hearing before an administrative law judge, they can recover costs only if the DNR order is dismissed. And I am asking, what happens if the order is not dismissed, but it is significantly modified? Again, in my hypothetical, DNR says you have to do these 10 things to be in compliance, and the ALJ says I find 9 of those 10 things totally unreasonable, but the 10th thing you ought to do. By my reading of Representative Hansen's bill, I'd still be ineligible to recover anything, even though I essentially prevailed on 90% of the claim. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the ALJ would make a recommendation at that point on whether it should be dismissed and whether costs should be included.
Any other questions? Okay, then.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call. And I'd do so. I'd ask members to pay particular attention on if you have any farmers in your district, how this can ultimately affect them.
I'm trying to remember.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I would ask members to support House File 3429 as amended. I think with Reverend Cole's amendment, we have tried to address some of the concerns. I should note that this authority is provided to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I think it provides another of the proverbial tools in the toolbox that folks can use to achieve compliance on the ground.
Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Bigham.
Aye.
Representative Cornish.
Go ahead. What? Representative Cornish. Go ahead. Yes or no?
Yes.
This is better than a go ahead.
Yes.
That's a yes.
Yes.
Representative Dina Forrest.
No.
Representative Emmer.
No.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hoberg.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Kalin.
Aye.
Representative Calls.
No.
Representative Kranz.
Aye.
Representative Lesch.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Saylor.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Aye.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrom.
No.
Oh, Representative Mullery.
Yes. It's easy to forget. Okay, the bill carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a point of information. What was the vote count?
11 to... Was it 10 or 11?
11-6.
Yeah. Representative Wofford.
Mr. Chair, the motion on that bill was to finance or to the general register?
I believe to the general register. Wasn't it? Did it go to finance? It goes to finance.
Is that what the motion was? I think that's what the motion was, Mr. Chair. I think that's where it's going.
I'm sure it was. I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler. Would
I will move your bill, Representative Loeffler, 3257. Are there any amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, yes, there's a gluten-free amendment that reflects a lot of hard work from a lot of people who are concerned with this issue, both the state and local level.
That's coming out. It's being passed out.
One of the things passed out, would you like me to just do a brief overview?
Yes, Representative Loeffler, I was just going to say, why don't you start?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Since 2003, as you are probably more aware than most committees, there's been a major effort towards increased use of civil commitment as a response to sex offenders with serious issues. And since then, the number referred to civil commitment who are being held in secure facilities, usually after serving prison terms, has risen dramatically. And along with that dramatic rise has risen dramatic cost to counties. And this bill and the amendment before you represent the work of a lot of people. I have Keith Carlson here from the Minnesota Intercounty Association, but they convened representatives from the state, from the local level, from the courts, and have been working on working on this issue so that there's more options in terms of addressing local costs while also respecting the need for these individuals to be securely supervised.
Now that it's out, I'll move the DE3 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Loeffler, do you want your Mr. Carlson to testify?
Mr. Chair, I think that this would be an appropriate time to recognize Mr. Keith Carlson.
Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and as Representative Loeffler said, through my organization, convened a working group on the subject of the process of civil commitment. Before I get into the details of the bill, I just want to briefly touch on that process. Counties right now are really the parties who are the exclusive agents on behalf of the state and the citizens on the front end of that process. County attorneys are responsible for prosecuting the civil commitment petitions, and obviously the county incurs those costs. The counties are responsible for the hold costs of the individuals who are the subjects of those petitions while they're being held at St. Peter or Moose Lake during the time that that petition is being processed. And once a decision is made on that petition, for those individuals who are actually committed, the counties are responsible for 10% of those costs for however long that individual remains at the secure treatment facilities. As Representative Loeffler said, counties have seen their costs, their workload increase extraordinarily. I believe a document that's entitled Background Materials, House File 3257, have been distributed to the committee. And I think as the longer-term members of the committee know, at the end of 2003, after the abduction and ultimately what turned out to be the murder of Drew Shadeen, the Department of Corrections changed its policy for the referral of individuals for consideration for civil commitment. And basically at that point started referring most level 3 sex offenders for consideration for civil commitment to the county attorneys. And basically if you look at the first page of the handout, you'll see that the number of referrals went from basically a handful each year to in the neighborhood of from 150 to over 200 a year. And obviously the workload, the cost of the prosecution, the petition rose significantly as a result of that. But most alarmingly from the county's point of view, if you turn to the second page, our hold costs for these individuals also rose dramatically. In fact, they've risen over 11-fold between the period from 2003 to 2007. I can't identify any other cost that we have seen increase faster in that period of time. That cost runs $368 a day according to the 2007 per diem that is being charged to us, and frankly, we don't see that cost falling in the near future. It is also a major cost for the state, as I think, again, the members know. Shortly, the state will be bringing online 400 new beds at the Moose Lake treatment facility. And if current trends continue, they will be back. Department of Human Services will be back in just a matter of a couple years asking for another 400 beds to be added to that. The final thing I want to speak to is I think at least some of the members of the committee may be under the misimpression that the issues for the counties have been addressed by a couple of changes that the legislature has made since 2003. First of those changes was requiring 1 year's of notice when the Department of Corrections makes the referral for civil commitment. The second of those is a more recent change that requires the county attorneys, upon receiving that referral, to file the petition if they elect to go forward with it within 120 days of receiving that referral. Neither have frankly been successful in holding down our cost or workload. First of those is addressed by the last page of the handout. And that is for those offenders who were referred in 2006 and then subsequently petitioned for commitment, of which there were 65 at the time that this was prepared late in 2007. We received the 1 year notice in only 21 out of the 65 instances, meaning that only less, approximately one-third of the offenders did we receive enough notice to have that 1 year period of time to get the petition process initiated and hopefully completed before those individuals ultimately come out of prison. I want to make it very clear that this is not the fault of the Department of Corrections. It's primarily the fault of the fact that many of the individuals that they're dealing with are what I refer to as short-timers, individuals who come into the DOC's facilities with relatively short sentences of approximately 14 months or less, and it just does not fit that one-year cycle, and consequently, they have to scramble to do the evaluation to see whether or not these people warrant civil commitment, and then they turn around and send it to us in as quickly as they can, but obviously it does not meet the 1 year. With regards to the 120 days, certainly that requirement does put it in black and white that the county attorneys have to initiate the petition within 120 days of starting the referral, but that does not mean that that individual is actually committed within that time period. That's just the start of the process that the attorneys tell me can take as long, frequently as long as 8 months. Mr. Chair, then members, with that, I'll just briefly touch on the bill. I have had a summary of the Delete Everything Amendment distributed. And basically, there are only two major provisions or initiatives in this bill. The new sections 1, 2, 3, and 5, previously sections 2 and 4 of the bill, basically gives sex offenders who are being petitioned for civil commitment the option to elect to stay in the Department of Corrections facility if they happen to already be imprisoned in that facility, or in the alternative, if the county elect, offer them the opportunity to stay in a county correctional or detention facility. They can never stay in either one of those institutions beyond the end of their executed sentence or their conditional release, so we do not run afoul of constitutional or legal issues. And there are a number of process provisions in here to make sure that the offender is making knowing election, that it's done on the record, and that they have an opportunity to revoke, and that they're also subject to the rules and regulations of the Department of Corrections if that's where they elect to stay. We believe that many offenders will, in fact, make such an election. Section 4 of the Delete Everything Amendment, then, is a data practices change. that allows the county attorney to get Department of Corrections records and probation or parole records earlier than they can right now. Right now, upon the Department of Corrections referral of an offender for consideration for commitment, at that point, basically the file is turned over on the individual and his or her treatment history, or whether or not they participated in treatment whatsoever, if they failed, and so on, becomes available to the county attorneys. One of the things that was identified in the working group that I referenced earlier was that there may be instances where county attorneys want to initiate the process earlier before they receive the referral, but obviously they need this information to determine whether or not a petition is warranted and then to prosecute the petition. I do have John Kerwin of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, who drafted much of the language before you, to answer any questions. And I also just want to conclude by saying the Board of Public Defense has reviewed this legislation and has raised no concerns with it, as has the Department of Corrections with the amendment. It is supported by the Minnesota Association of Community Correction Act Counties, as well as the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Association of Community Social Service Act Counties. Also supports this in concept. They have not had an opportunity to take a formal stance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the bill.
Pardon?
I have a question on the bill.
Go ahead.
So I don't know if you...
No, go ahead.
Minister. Yeah. All right. My question relates to page 4, starting on 410 in the language relative to the access to data. Notwithstanding any provision of Chapter 13 or any other state law, I mean, that's the Mack truck of all Mack trucks. Why don't you just state what they can get and where they can get it from? I mean, it's just unbelievable how this is written, because there's no reining it in at all. I'm going to move to delete this section of the bill, and then ask that Representative Loeffler work with Representative Simon, and maybe we can put something in the data practices bill to address this issue. But this is the Mack truck of all Mack trucks, and with no notice to the patient and the wide access that this gives, I just think that we're making a big mistake if we pass it as it stands, in order to save the committee time if we just delete it now and work on it in the process.
Representative Holbert, since Mack trucks aren't the biggest trucks, does that mean this is just kind of a medium-sized problem? Or,
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Loeffler, I'd like to have John Kerwin respond here.
Mr. Kerwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert. The language, notwithstanding any provision of Chapter 13 or other state law, is... really identical but shorter than the language that begins the entire subdivision. If you look back to the previous page on page 3, line 29. And the way that this limits the information that can be provided is that it's only data from the Department of Corrections or the local probation or parole agency that can be provided to the county attorney. I think many people might think that that kind of information is already available to the county attorney to make this kind of decision, but it's not under the Data Practices Act. There is a provision that, and it's in Chapter 244.05, Subdivision 7, I believe, that says that when the Department of Corrections makes a referral to a county attorney's office, then upon request, the county attorney can get the Department of Corrections records. One of the things that Micah recommended was that county attorneys look at some cases earlier, and particularly in situations when the person is on parole or probation in the county. And the county attorneys thought that in order to do that, they would again want to be able to get any Department of Corrections records they have, but also the probation or parole records. And so I understand the concern that you're raising, and we attempted to address it by limiting it to those three kinds of information.
And Mr. Chair, in earlier you get notice to the individual person, and you limit to the extent that it relates to the patient for the purpose of determining whether good cause exists. So there's some limitations within that
thing. You pick up the language of the notwithstanding, but you don't really narrow down, and there's no notice to the patient. It's kind of like comparing apples and oranges with how you're using the data.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thurwin, I have just a question about how to settle it. I don't really have an objection to the policy aim here of getting them the information more quickly, but I agree with Representative Holbert that putting it here may not be the best thing to the average Joe and Jane. Not that the average Joe and Jane is casually thumbing through the statute books, but maybe they are at some point. And not putting this in Chapter 13 might be a problem. I mean, would you be okay with just taking the same language, putting it somewhere in Chapter 13 as one of the exceptions or exemptions?
Representative Simon, I think that would also be workable. The same thing could be accomplished by putting it there, and to making these exceptions to the provisions dealing with corrections data and parole and probation data.
Okay. Well, what we could do then, thank you, Mr. Chair, is, you know, I assume at some point here we're gonna the bill that we did last night and the subcommittee is going to come before this committee, and we could pretty easily, I think, insert a provision just to make sure it's in that section so that people looking at what they can and can't do under the Data Practices Act don't have to look any further than that. If that would be okay with you, that might be a cleaner way to do it. I understand Representative Holberg to be saying she's not nothing about the policy in general. I don't have that same objection. It's just where we put it to be fairer to people who are looking to see what they can and can't do. That might be a better way to do it.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I want people to have the information that they need to keep the public safe, but you're looking at a situation considering civil commitment, no court order, not telling the individual subject, and this wide open authority. And I think the combination of all those elements is too much.
I'm not sure exactly where you're headed. Are you headed, both of you, towards taking it out here, or?
Mr. Chair, I move to delete Section 4 is what I move.
The whole Holberg moves to delete Section 4. Representative Olin?
I speak in opposition of deleting Section 4. As a prior county attorney who has done the civil commitments more than once on the Rodriguez's of the world, I would hate to see a process made that would stop us from being able to effectively keep the extreme sexual sexopath off the streets, because believe me, we've already had an instance up next to my county that's involving me, and I'd hate to see any more instances allowing these people on the streets too easily.
Representative De La Forest, to the amendment?
It is to the amendment, Mr. Chairman. The question I had is I've heard Representative Owen's comments, but as I read the executive summary on page 2, the rationale given for this language is, quote-unquote, to minimize cost. And so I would like to know, is this to minimize cost? I will take Mike at their word, and it is to minimize cost. I'd like to know, what kind of costs are we minimizing here? Because we are certainly minimizing due process. So before I vote on the amendment, I'd like to ask that question.
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, the reference to minimize cost is to minimize the period of the hold. Again, by allowing the initiation of the process before the county receives the referral from the Department of Corrections, it is hoped that either by the end of their criminal sanction, their incarceration with DOC, or possibly with the county, that the petition could be completed by allowing this earlier access to the data. So it's basically minimizing the hold cost and ultimately minimizing the state's capital outlay for building more beds at their sex offender treatment facilities.
Representative Waller.
I think another thing might enter in, and that's the, if you're looking at strictly costs, if I'm sitting in Pennington County and I have to have a hearing in front of a judge, bring the defendant to Pennington County, appointing a court-appointed attorney who won't necessarily be the one that'll end up with a civil commitment hearing, and then transporting back before we actually have all the paperwork, we're looking at well over $1,000, if not $2,000 or $3,000, to cost the Pennington County.
President Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One way to do this, Mr. Kerwin, would be instead of to yank this out via the amendment, what we could do is, and I don't think we have time to do it today, but is the next step the floor at this point, or is it going to
finance?
Well, maybe what we could do instead is amend it in finance to make sure that it's an amendment to Chapter 13. I just personally feel that the references to Chapter 13 should be in Chapter 13 where possible, so as not to catch people off guard. And if you'd be agreeable to that, then I would prefer that personally over the amendment. I don't have the same policy concerns that Representative Hoberg does, but I do think if we're going to mention Chapter 13, we should just amend Chapter 13 rather than doing a notwithstanding in some other section of law. So if you want to do it that way, and we can work on an amendment that would go at its next stage, that would be an actual amendment to Chapter 13, it seems to me that would be cleaner. I don't know what you think about that.
Mr. Kerwin, Simon, I think that either would be workable. I think that an amendment could be written to Chapter 13 to accomplish the same thing.
Okay, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no.
No.
Fail.
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you another thing then.
Well, Mr. Hulbert, we have gone over our time, so we are recessed to convene immediately in room 500 North. Put all of the rest of your documents that haven't been used in your folders and bring them up. Meeting is in recess. Please reconvene. Representative Loeffler, my understanding from your witness that amendment, there is no fiscal note after that amendment passed.
Oh, it's amendment.
Oh. Okay, Representative Carlson, what were you? I'm sorry to demean you, but
okay.
He worked in the Senate, you know. We only have to kneel on one knee when we're talking to him rather than two knees like the whole Senate. Mr. Carlson, what were you? You were saying that the amendment passed. No.
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment explicitly provides that to the extent the individual elects to stay in a DOC facility, that the county paid for that. So we believe there's no fiscal cost to this, and the section one that was deleted by the amendment would have deleted or eliminated any cost for the Department of Human Services.
Okay, so then the understanding of the chair is, and Mr. Carter, is that correct with the delete all on 3257? It doesn't have to go to finance?
Mr. Chair, I think we're discussing that since the Department of Corrections says there still is a cost to this. So one option I would suggest is we could send it to finance and put in for a complete fiscal note by Friday, and maybe Chairman Seymour will hear it on Friday. And
okay. Well, if it goes to finance, it doesn't have to be out by Friday. Representative Loeffler, we're back to your bill. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Cornish and
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler and the witness, is there anything in this bill whatsoever that would make it easier or quicker or anything else for the sex offender to get out or released or early out or give consideration or anything in the sex offender's benefits towards release?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, no. There's nothing that changes the underlying policy regarding the commitment of these individuals. If they are in a Department of Corrections facility and still serving their criminal sanction, they will stay there until they've completed their sanction. The commitment is still determined by the existing process, whether or not they will be committed, and this does nothing to affect the term of their commitment if that is the ultimate decision of the UA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a policy question. Are we then saying, I mean, I support the bill, but are we then saying then that the whole diagnosis relative to a psychopathic personality that we're moving from that from that position, because I'm assuming that if the offender stays in a Department of Corrections facility, they're not going to get any treatment. Am I wrong on this?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Representative Hamar, the fact of the matter is right now individuals who are on hold orders do not routinely receive treatment. The Department of Human Services, so I don't believe there's any representative here, has just informed me that they've recently changed their policy and provided treatment for those offenders under hold orders who request it, but that's a small fraction of those that are on hold orders. So there's nothing really changing the treatment regimen for those individuals. There's nothing preventing DOC from providing treatment if they have the capacity, or it's a continuation of the programming that they were receiving if they elect to stay in the institution. And again, if under the current scheme, routinely they do not receive treatment while the petition is being processed.
Mr. Chair, how long does the petition take?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamar, it does depend. I'm told by the county attorneys that it is not unusual for the process to take as long as 8 months. And other treatments, that's not the correct term. They do receive recreational therapy. They may receive vocational therapy, but again, they do not routinely receive what you think of as sex offender treatment while they're under the hold.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members should have an amendment that I'd like to offer that pertains to what we talked about when we were in the other room. It's the A99 amendment, and Mr. Gehring was kind enough to write it down. And all this does is put in a reference in Chapter 13 to the statute we're talking about now, a cross-reference. And this at least solves my problem. To be fair, I don't think it solves President Holder's problem with language. He has different issues with it. But from my standpoint, I think we're talking about Chapter 13 in other sections of the code. It's kind of a problem, so we should have a reference in there to Chapter 13. So a person looking to see what their rights are under Chapter 13 can find them in Chapter 13. That's all it is.
So I assume that you're moving this.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I move the amendment, the A99.
Representative Simon moved the A99 amendment. The author.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's always good to get more intelligent cross-reference.
Okay, in other words, you support the amendment. Okay, Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I don't know if you'd be willing to comment or not, but I share some of Representative Holberg's concerns. I'm not sure that quite to the same degree that she does, but what have we typically done with these provisions? And don't we typically have an omnibus data practices bill, and shouldn't it be there so we can consider all these together? I'm wondering if this is the right place for this provision, or if it belongs in your bill, or maybe in both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pope. I would say ideally it would be left out more fully in Chapter 13, but I'll take the cross-reference. At least a person reading can figure out that, okay, here's Chapter 13, here's someplace else I've got to look for a modification. So, I mean, considering that we're doing this kind of on the fly, I'll certainly take this. And we're already done with the bill. It's put together. We can always add onto it when it comes before this committee, but as a practical matter, this seems like the best available solution. But to be fair, it doesn't solve President Holder's concerns.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I don't think it does solve her concerns, and I would just respectfully encourage you to consider maybe chatting with her before this goes to the floor, because I trust it will be an issue when it comes to the floor. I have a concern, I guess, less so about the... I'm not sure how I feel about the court order, the lack of a need for a court order, but I am concerned about a lack of need to provide any information to the individual that the data is being provided to the county attorney about them. So I'm going to be voting no on the amendment, but Representative Loeffler, I hope you'll chat with Representative Holder before this goes to the floor, because I suspect you may spend some time on the floor with it otherwise.
I'm always glad to work with people who bring issues forward with the best of intent. I think the whole intent here is to make the process move faster, not in front of other people's rights, but to make sure that the information is there. And I think, in general, I tend to think that the state and the counties are partners in this, and subject to the same data privacy restrictions and considering things. But we'll make sure that we have a conversation with Representative Holberg and address her concerns about how this might get to them.
Okay, Representative Simon renews his motion for A99 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carry. Representative Loeffler, any other discussion? Okay, then I think my understanding from Mr. Carter is that this should go to finance. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's agreeable. Okay, then the chair renews his motion to pass as amended, and that it be re-referred to finance with a recommendation to go to public safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Kalin. Representative Kalin moves 3690.
Mr. Chair, I do not have an amendment to call 3690. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3690 is the one you've gotten all the emails about, a very controversial bill. It's the 2008 policy bill for the Department of Corrections. And I do apologize for all the emails you have gotten. With me today is the Rush City Warden and Warden at the Capitol, Terry Carlson, here for moral support, and for technical support is Ken Mers from the Department of Corrections. I'm going to actually hand it off to Mr. Mers to walk through the bill, and then we'll sit for any questions and ask for your support.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify this bill? Okay, Mr. Mers, could you quite quickly walk through it?
Very quickly, Mr. Chair. My name is Ken Mers. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. And as Representative Kalin said, this is our housekeeping, our technical bill. And we're basically just trying to clean up some language and statutes. Section 1 and Section 3 basically do the same thing. They refer to the Interstate Compact Statute. The first one is the statute which requires fingerprinting of offenders who come to us from another state, and they reference the Interstate Compact Statute. Section 3 talks about getting a DNA collection, and it references the Interstate Compact Statute. 3 years ago, the compact was revised, and a new compact was adopted with a new number. These sites were not changed, and so they are simply updating the statutes from the old compact statute to the new statute. Section 2 also deals with the interstate compact. Currently, we are required to have a report on January 15th to the legislature. However, the National Office for the Interstate Compact operates on a calendar year, so they don't have their data available to us so that we can include it in our state report. So what we're simply asking here is that we move our state report back to March 15th. That way we can include the data from the National Office. or Marchford, I'm sorry.
Yes, Marchford.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any. Are we?
We have a couple.
Okay.
Sections 4 and 5 simply are trying to clean up some outdated language from the county jail statutes, which refers to solitary confinement. That's a term that's not used anymore. We're simply changing that to secure confinement. It also eliminates some outdated time frames for disciplinary or solitary confinement. And we're simply putting in language that simply states that the secure confinement for a period of time is defined by the facility's discipline policy. Because under the new rules and then promulgated that all jails are under, they need to follow that. They're actually stricter rules than what is currently in the statute. So we refer it to their policy. The section 6 and, or I'm sorry, section 5 simply replaces the word solitary with secure also. Section 6 are the repealers. The first repealer repeals the language for juvenile residential treatment grants. The funding for those grants was eliminated during the deficit fix in 2003, so there is no money. So we're simply eliminating the language from the statute. The same for the juvenile restitution grant language. That program is no longer in existence because that money has been eliminated also. The last repealer just simply eliminates a juvenile out-of-home placement report by the Department of Corrections. A task force was put together between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services that has made a recommendation that counties develop their own comprehensive programs for out-of-home placements, and therefore it's no longer necessary by the department. And Mr. Chair, that's the bill.
Okay. Don't see a lot of discussion with the if there's going to fail, and we need to have a motion to pass, and it goes to the general rate.
Yes.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
Representative Begum, House File 3342. Would you like to move your bill?
Yeah. I would like to move House File 3342, recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Excellent. Do you have any amendments?
No, I do not. And with me today is Anne-Marie from the Department of Public Safety, specifically dealing with the Predator Offenders Registry. And if you read the bill, it's very similar to one that passed last year and got lost in translation. And this year the department came back to me and had some technical amendments. So I'm going to just briefly go over the part that passed unanimously last year, which was that upon the intake of a jail facility, the name of the inmate must be checked with the BCA Predator Offender Registration. And if they are on that registry, they have to, the BCA has to be notified. And that was part of the bill last year, and now I will turn it over to Ms. O'Neill to talk about the new technical provision.
Welcome, Ms. O'Neill. Please identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anne-Marie O'Neill from the Predatory Offender Registration Unit at the BCA. We do have a couple of technical changes to the registration statute, starting at the beginning of the bill. The reason for the technical change regarding homeless offenders who are going to be released from incarceration, this past September, we had a level 3 offender who's being prepared to be released from incarceration at one of the correctional facilities. She had served to expiration, so she was not going to have a supervising agent when she got out. and he was refusing to notify the Department of Corrections and the DCA on where he intended to live upon release. His argument for why he did not have to provide that information was that he was going to be homeless, and he could leave the correctional facility, and he had 24 hours from the time he left the correctional facility before he had to tell anyone where he was actually going. And obviously that was a grave concern for the DCA and the Department of Corrections. Basically made it impossible to retain a notification for that offender, and really kept a lot of resources, or potentially kept a lot of resources, to track this individual for 24 hours until he actually landed somewhere. So it was certainly a great concern that he would leave the state without notifying us. So we are asking that people that are released from prison, if who intend to be homeless or lack of memory as of upon their release, still have to report at least 5 days in advance what community or jurisdiction they intend to be homeless in. The second theme is the sufficiency notice. This is a recommendation from some local prosecutors who advised the DC that it would assist the enforcement of failure to register violations if the sufficiency notice was included in the statute. Apparently there was some issues with prosecuting an offender for failure to register, and an argument about how he was served with his annual verification letters, and again a certain suggestion from local prosecutors. And then the last is in the Crimes Against a Person statute, which is Minnesota Statute 243.167. We believe that we had fixed this scheme in 2005. What we're still seeing, though, is defense attorneys arguing that the Crimes Against a Person statute does not apply as written currently to offenders who committed their offenses or their sexual offenses in other states and have completed the registration period or were not required to register in the other state, and then moved to Minnesota and commit a crime against a person. And we felt that this was fixed in 2005 by inserting section in subdivision 2, part 2, just the reference to the registration statute. But we're just feeling like we need to really be explicit and say what a comparable offense in another state to make sure that that's clear.
Thank you, Ms. O'Neill. Questions from
the board? Questions, if there are any?
Representative Tamar.
To Ms. O'Neill or to Representative Bigham, under Section 4, two questions. Is there any cost to the BCA? And then the second question would be, would there be a county, would there be a financial impact of county, thinking especially in the seven county metropolitan area, where there'd be a fair amount of offenders?
Mr. Chair and Chair Paymar, my understanding is that this is an online registration, which local governments already have access to. All we're asking them to, as part of their booking process, is to double check that this person is not on that registry. So my understanding is that it is not, there is no fiscal impact. At least last year there wasn't. We didn't change any of this part of the bill. Last year there wasn't a local impact or to the BCA, but I can have Ms. O'Neill.
Ms. O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is no fiscal impact at this time. We already have made this available, this service available to many, to all of the sheriffs. And some sheriff's offices, including the Hennepin County Jail, are already doing this on a voluntary basis. We just want to get a consistent practice statewide. And really, the intention here, why we're asking for this, is what's happening is some of our non-compliant offenders are getting booked into jail for a DWI or some other offense. And it's an opportunity to bring them back into compliance and get an updated address on them. And they're being booked and released, and the DCA is never notified that they're back in the jail. So we're hopeful that by checking the POR database as part of the intake process, we'll be able to increase our compliance rate.
So final question, this must have been part of current law, too, but you're amending it. But am I reading correctly? Every sheriff who intentionally neglects or refuses to report under paragraph A or B shall be guilty of a gross misdemeanor?
And Chair Paymar, what we didn't want was for somebody to
if they forgot, you know, that not be in trouble, disciplined for that. But if they intentionally didn't do it, we wanted them to be held accountable. Sorry, Representative Cornish.
And Representative Bigham, you're actually making it tougher for a law enforcement official, for a sheriff to be, to commit a gross misdemeanor.
Right, right. That's what I'm trying to say, is that if it was an accident, yeah, we're making it tougher.
I'm sure Representative Cornish and his colleagues are appreciate that you're looking out for them. Any other questions from members?
Yeah.
Representative Cornish, probably to that point, huh?
Representative Bingham, did you confer with the Sheriff's Association or about this section?
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, Superintendent O'Malley has confirmed with them and they are okay with it.
Representative Cornish, as Representative Coles, I think, is explaining to you, it actually increases the threshold that prosecutors will have to meet to bring a sheriff in, so that
see that from just neglect to intentional.
Representative Cornish, that's correct.
Yep. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Any other questions from members? Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, I can renew my motion.
Please do.
To pass House File 3342 to the General Register.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So it's passed. Thank you, Representative Bigham. Representative Johnson. Welcome to your committee, Representative Johnson. And I suppose you'd like to move House File 3583.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move my bill recommended to pass and go to General Register.
So moved, and proceed with your bill. Representative Johnson, do you have any amendments?
I have an oral amendment I'd like to make, Mr. Chair.
You can hold on 1 second. Here we go. Proceed with your oral amendment.
The oral amendment is as follows. It's going to make the bill much simpler. Delete Section 1, and then on page 2, line 29, reinstate the stricken language, and on line 2, or on page 2, lines 31 to 34, delete the new language. So what's this?
Representative Johnson, I just want to indicate the committee should observe line 2.17 and 2.18, correct?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. Representative Johnson has moved to delete section 1, reinstate the stricken language on line 2.29, and remove the new language on 2.31 to 2.34. Any questions? Since this is a large portion of the bill, I just want to see if members have any questions. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this amended bill proposes to do is a change in the length of time juvenile history data on a child is retained before being destroyed. The change is from 6 months to a year after the child's arrest if the child hasn't been referred to a diversion program and no petition has been filed. And this is a bill the BCA has requested with us is Julie Letourneau-Lackner from the Department of Public Safety, and she's going to explain the rationale for the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Letourneau-Lackner. I hope I got your name correctly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Julie Letourneau-Lackner. I am the CGIS manager with the BCA, and the issue is that 6 months is not long enough for business processes to take place and be reflected on the juvenile adjudication history. If a petition is filed, we are not notified until the case is heard in court and a disposition that is reportable to the BCA is sent by the court. So extending this time frame allows us to appropriately destroy a fingerprint card or fingerprints when that does not take place.
Question from members. Representative Simon, you good?
Yeah.
Great. Representative Willie.
You want to know if I'm okay?
I'm okay.
No. Any other questions from members? Alright, thank you, Ms. Letourneau-Lackner.
I'll do my motion then, Mr. Chair.
The motion is, President Johnson renews his motion that House File 3583 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended, thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Simon, I believe that you're going to present Representative Hilton's bill, House File 3683.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pinch-hitting for Representative Hilton, who couldn't be here today because of the scheduling conflict. Just a couple of points about the bill, about House File 3683. This is the output of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group, made up of executive branch commissioners, judicial branch members, and others. And this was vetted through and recommended by the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force. And these recommendations were adopted in 2007. Section 1 just adds a section of Minnesota statutes for the e-charging service. It would be the new section 299.41. Section 2 is really the for substantive change, and it would require certain kinds of fingerprinting. Currently, law enforcement agencies are responsible for taking fingerprints, but sometimes fingerprints are not taken, and there's no backstop for making sure that fingerprints have been taken. So the lack of fingerprints contributes to the number of records in suspense in the criminal history system. This language would tighten the current fingerprinting requirements by requiring that the fingerprint shall be taken for any adults or juveniles admitted to jails or detention facilities, in addition to other situations where fingerprinting is required. The language would also require fingerprints to be obtained no later than the release from booking or prior to acceptance of a plea of guilty or not guilty. And if fingerprints have not been successfully received by the BCA, this language would allow the individual upon order of a court to be taken into custody for no more than 8 hours to be fingerprinted. Section 3 of the bill pertains to e-charging data classification. Right now, there's no centralized process available to allow law enforcement and prosecution to electronically prepare and transmit charging documents with the courts. It's still like a manual paper process. So the e-charging service is being developed at the BCA to provide this electronic transmission of data and documents. And the service has been designed and is moving into the testing phase with 4 pilot counties between now and August. So this e-charging service will not be a permanent data repository, but will serve as the infrastructure for the workflow. There's some other more specific technical things that others could probably answer better than I, but you know, I should probably move the bill, which I haven't done yet, Mr. Chair.
I thought you had, but that's okay. Go ahead and move House File 3683 to the General Register.
I think it's to the General Register. Okay, well then I will move that House File 3683 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to testifiers who can probably fill in a lot of the blanks.
Welcome, sir, to the committee. If you state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is David Johnson, and I am the Executive Director of CRIMNET, and have been in place now for approximately 2 months after 31 years in law enforcement. So it's been a nice change for me. Section 2, the required fingerprinting, as Representative Simon has indicated, closes some of the gaps in missing fingerprints that helps us close the loop and reduce the number of issues that are going to suspense file that cannot be matched up, criminal events and court events that are not matched up because of the lack of a fingerprint card, thereby completing the criminal history document. And again, as the representative has indicated, this would then require the fingerprint be taken upon admission to a juvenile detention facility, upon booking at a jail, upon release of a jail if it had been not taken, before receiving a plea in a court setting, and at the last opportunity by order of the court for no longer than 8 hours. again, the purpose of this, again, is to make sure with the greatest amount of integrity we can to link up that criminal justice event to a biometric indicator and make sure that the criminal history is accurate. And that is the section two, and I can stop at that point, Mr. Chair, if you wish.
We can just check in if there are questions from members. All right, why don't you proceed with the e-charging section, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, members, e-charging is a system that is currently under development by the CRIMNET and CJIS offices. It's a manner and mechanism that allows data from a law enforcement agency to be transmitted to a prosecuting attorney, whether that be a county attorney or a local prosecuting attorney, for consideration of a criminal charge that would be completed electronically. After the prosecuting attorney has their consideration, they have the ability to send that data back for correction or addition, or to draft a complaint and send that complaint back to the police officer who is going to act as the affiant or the signing individual. The officer then has the opportunity to verify that the complaint is true and correct, and to swear by oath in an electronic fashion verified by a notary, and then to transmit the complaint electronically to a judge. The judge then has the ability to review that and sign off on the complaint if they so desire, and file it with the court. It is believed that this process will be a great benefit to the criminal justice community, not only local law enforcement, but prosecutors and the court itself, especially in rural settings where carrying these types of documents may be of great inconvenience and time-consuming. This has been a priority project for the CRIMNET program office, come up from the constituents that are representative in the task force. The manner and means in which this is going to be taken care of is the credentialing and the e-charging system. Available today is Mr. Tom Miller, who's the program manager, who can ask the technical questions, but as this project moves forward into the test phase with the four test counties, which are Kandy, Ojai, Homestead, Carver, and St. Louis, became aware that the data within the framework of how this takes place, the transmission, the workflow, and the credentialing of the individual signing did not have a data classification. And so this law that you see, or excuse me, this bill that's in front of you today, then puts the assessment pursuant to state statute stating that certain portions of this data are private and certain portions of this data are confidential. And that is the purpose for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I know a couple of members have questions. I have one before we get to those, and that is, I understand that the court system has been moving to a more integrated database and electronic system, and I'm wondering if how the, it's been an issue, I know in Chicago County, I think in other counties as well, are you aware of how this, obviously with a four-county pilot, we'll be able to judge better for the future, but have you been looking at, in the e-charging system, how well it dovetails with the electronic system for the court administration?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the CRIMNET Program Office and CJIS are looking at all of the opportunities of integrating all elements of the criminal justice information system and to make sure that we can do all of this efficiently and effectively. So all of those aspects are under consideration, and all of the standards are being written in such a way that when the possibility of integration exists, that we can do it in the most reasonable of fashion.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, did you want to comment briefly? Or
are you good? Available if they want to go. Happy to speak, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Miller, if you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Tom Miller. I am a CRIMNET business analyst and the project manager for the charging project for CRIMNET. To answer your question specifically, we are working very closely with the courts on integration with their e-filing service, and their e-filing service is a necessary precondition for us to be able to submit information to the court. What they are handling is what they have set up is a system that allows information to be submitted into MNSIS and automatically create the court files. What we are creating is everything that needs to occur prior to that, which would handle the incident submission to the prosecutor, the prosecution generation of the complaint, The complaint submission to the law enforcement officer for oath swearing, the electronic signature from the officer, the submittal to the judge, and the approval of the judge, which would all then occur and be submitted in the minutes. Currently, the filing service does not allow electronic signature and requires a parallel paper process to happen. And while it adds value, we're trying to add value on top of that. And we've been working very closely with the court to make sure that our projects are in sync and will succeed in fulfilling our mutual goals.
I appreciate that, Mr. Miller. It's probably the number one administrative concern when I did my most recent ride-along with our county attorney for the day. That was the number one administrative issue that they've been dealing with, to the point of, as you know, having to actually not hear cases for half a day in some of our county courts to deal with this issue. So I appreciate that and look forward to hearing back the results of the test project. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, well, first of all, the new director and I graduated from police school 31 years ago. This is a good bill. I just had a conversation with our state patrol the other day, and they've got these suspense files, and there was a young lady at the patrol headquarters in Mankato that's working through about 75 or 80 of them. These suspense files, and one of the largest causes is the lack of fingerprints and missing fingerprints at the jail or somewhere down through the process. So anything that we can do to tighten up on the fingerprinting process saves a lot of paperwork and man or woman hours and tracking these down. So once they get past the jail and we lose the opportunity that first time, then it just snowballs from down the road. And then the e-charging is even better. The integration of the courts and the jail and the system and networking this all together is something that they've really been struggling with year after year here, and finally getting ready for the 21st century. It's really going to be a slick outfit once it gets underway.
Thanks, Representative Cornish. Representative Coles.
To the new director from CrimNet, as I understand your testimony about the e-charging system, the hardware, the software, the process already exists. This is just dealing with the data. I was surprised when I didn't see a fiscal note or any cost. It sounds like that work's already been done. Is that correct?
Mr. Gunn.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct. That work is being done as we speak. It's ready for pilot testing, and there is no fiscal impact. This is simply a data classification issue.
Mr. Chair, I have another question, and just an assignment. I know this isn't your bill, and I hate to kind of put you on the spot about this, but Section 2, Line 22, seems to me to be rather broad. And maybe I don't understand what it means to be admitted to a jail or detention facility, but it seems to me that would now authorize or, in fact, require the collection of fingerprints from somebody who is arrested and brought to jail for anything, whereas if you look at line 17 and 18 current law, it says people arrested for a felony, gross misdemeanor, or a targeted misdemeanor. So it seems like we're opening that wide open, and I'm a little concerned about the potential implications of that. That Representative Simon, do you know what's behind that, or is there somebody here who can talk to the policy behind why we would want to collect fingerprints from every single person who, you know, may have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time and, you know, spooked up?
Representative Paul, quickly, I have the same question, so I appreciate you asking that, Representative
Simon. Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm happy to defer to someone who does. All I can say, Representative Coles, is, you know, one of the test pilot counties is Carver County, so. Better not vote against the bill.
That's all I can say. Well, Mr. Chair, Simon, I think the test pilot, that's for the e-charge. This is a fingerprint issue, which applies, I believe, across the state. So I like the e-charging piece. I can't wait to support that. I'm a little concerned about how broad this might be.
I think
I'm just picturing the lid piece, that's all. Kidding, of course. I'm actually not sure about your question. Is there someone here who...
Mr. Miller.
Yes, the reason for that specific request is that currently the idea is when somebody comes into a jail, the jail wants to know if this person is a security risk, if they have outstanding warrants on them, or basically they establish who they are when they come in. The idea of fingerprinting, I mean, you can then find out whether this is somebody who, you, to avoid the potential mistake of putting somebody who would be potentially dangerous into a less secure environment, or to have let somebody who had a warrant out for them, but this was unknown, slip through your fingers. This is commonly practiced right now inside a lot of jails, because this is a standard business practice to make sure that they run the prints of anybody who gets put inside the jail, but it is not a statewide practice. The purpose of this is because it was deemed by the task force and the policy group that this would be a good statewide practice to have followed.
Are you aware of, you said the policy group, do the public defenders sit on the policy group? I believe they do.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hearing a...
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative, the public defenders are not represented on the policy group itself, but they are represented on the task force. They are a mandatory member pursuant to statute, and they give advice to the policy group.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the follow-up question then is, did the public defenders weigh in on this provision? And since there's nobody here, I mean, do we know what their position is? I mean, this, again, I'm supportive of the state using biometrics. I think it's the right thing to do, but within some reason, I don't...
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it was my understanding that at the task force level that there was consensus and support for this recommendation, and that consensus and support was transmitted to the policy group as part of their consideration. I might also add that as a practice now in most jails that have live scan capabilities, everyone who's brought in, remembering that you have to be committed a misdemeanor or a greater offense in order to be brought in for this process to occur, that all of these individuals are being fingerprinted now, and part of the live scan process and requiring that fingerprint is to seek out to see if that person is appropriately identified, whether or not they already exist in the database. Once that fingerprint card is taken, and then it is submitted to the DCA, then there are some decisions that are made whether that is attributed to a criminal history based upon whether it's a felony, gross misdemeanor, or a targeted misdemeanor under current statute.
Mr. Chairman, I think you may have satisfied my concern with something you just said. Do I understand you correctly to be telling me that jails currently have the discretionary authority to fingerprint anybody who walks in the door, or anybody who's brought there by law enforcement?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, Mr. Chair, in light of that, I mean, it sounds like we're requiring something they already have the discretionary authority to do. I guess I still have some concerns, but since Representative Bilstrom's not here, I'll support this getting out of here today, and if I need to, I'll talk with her. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coles. Representative Cornish, I do know you have a question, but I have a question to this point. It's
unknown. If we've resolved it, I'm fine.
You sure?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My follow-up, Mr. Johnson, is just on line 2.26, 2.25, 2.26 is the, and this goes to the discussion we just had about the timing of the fingerprint. And this is a qualifier. It's not that everybody who is booked is everybody who is brought in for questioning by law enforcement at all getting fingerprinted. Only those who are being booked and held in custody under this provision, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, not everyone who's brought in for questioning is fingerprinted. Fingerprinting is done when someone is arrested. Now, they're not always held in custody. You have the opportunity, if they do not pose a flight risk, if they qualify for release, and you apply the various rules of continued detention, they may be released at that point, or they may be held in custody. But at that point, it's when the fingerprint would be taken.
Representative Simon threatened for all of us, if we do vote against this bill, that we might all get taken in for questioning and fingerprinting. We'd have to actually get arrested and then booked and then fingerprinted. Just to personalize a little bit, just to make sure that I'm clarifying, I just want to make sure we're not bringing a wide net. I'm making wide a little bit here, but I want to make sure that this net is cast no wider than it absolutely needs to be, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the only time an individual's fingerprints are taken short of being arrested is with their consent. There are times in which an individual may be questioned and a law enforcement officer may ask if they are willing to give their fingerprints, but if they say they are unwilling, the fingerprints are not taken short of being arrested.
Thank you. Any other questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 3683 be recommended pass and referred to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. And motion prevails, the bill is passed.
And I believe there's no further business before us today, so we are adjourned.